Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. And on this evening's The Space Show, we are going to be looking at the 45th anniversary of Apollo 15. Yes, 45 years ago this week, landing on the moon. And we will have a second crack at playing a song about Michael Collins. We didn't quite finish it last week. And we've got Ed Buckby going to give us a few details about his experiences as a public affairs officer at NASA during the days of Apollo and Skylab. And, a little bit of poetry as well. And Laurie Anderson, do you know who she is? You should. Well, she's going to be singing for us a thing called The End of the Moon. She was a NASA resident artist for a while there. So let's get the show underway with Apollo 15. 1971, July the 26th to August the 7th. Yes, 45 years ago. Three people: Dave Scott, James Irwin, and Al Warden, Al for Alfred. They boarded the spaceship called Endeavour, Apollo 15, the Commander Service Module, and with them was a lunar module called Falcon, and tucked away aboard Falcon was a lunar roving vehicle that they were able to drive around on the moon. They drove for 27.9 kilometres. That's a fair whack, much further than they could have walked. They landed in the Hadley Apennine region. They did three extra vehicular activities. That means moonwalks. Actually, four if you count the one that on the way back from the moon. So three on the moon, 6 hours, 34 minutes, 7 hours and 12 minutes, and the last one was 4 hours and 50 minutes on three successive days. During their forays outside, they collected 78.6 kilograms of rock. They were on the lunar surface for 66 hours and 55 minutes. And meanwhile, the Command and Service Module, which had Al Warden, orbited the moon 74 times. They deployed a sub-satellite into lunar orbit. And on the way back from the moon, Al Warden did a 38-minute extravehicular activity in order to retrieve some film. The total mission time was 295 hours and 11 minutes, and they splashed down into the ocean north of Honolulu, which is, of course, in Hawaii. So why don't we pick up the commentary as it was heard at the time, and we're going to go now with the folks at CBS News, and this is a description of the landing site.
With me again for the flight of Apollo 15 is former astronaut, our good friend Wally Schirra. Wally, glad to have you along on all of these trips, but particularly this one, because this is going to be a pilot's trip, for sure enough, when they go down to that moon.
I really feel that, Walter, because you remember they're coming over this 15,000-foot mountain range, landing in a rather small area with a gorge, the Hadley Rill, just beyond that landing area. And, of course, as a Navy pilot, we land on small things, but I think they can handle this one quite well. They've had a lot of training.
Very kind of a Navy man to say that about an Air Force fellow, but they can make this carrier landing, as you put it. They do have to go over a 15,000-foot-high mountain range. That mountain range, the Apennines, is what makes this an interesting trip, of course, primarily, and the rill. We've never seen a rill before close up on the moon. Man hasn't explored one. These are these great canals on the moon that we can see from Earth, but we've never known precisely what they are. They hope to find out this time, but this one, the Hadley Rill, is a big one. It's almost a mile across, and it's around 1,000 feet deep. It's not like Grand Canyon. It's more like a V-shaped
slope. It slumped in, apparently. That's why it's interesting. It could be described as possibly a tube below the lunar surface that lava flowed through, and then as it settled out, it sort of slumped down. There's not the same gravity there. Of course, we have 1/6 gravity on the moon, but it definitely shows a falling in, or slumping is a classic word.
What man has proved in the Apollo program so far is that there never has been any water on the moon. That's one of the things we proved. And therefore, we know that this can't be erosion that has formed the same sort of valley and gorge on Earth. So it's got to be something else, and they don't really know what it is. It could be, as you say, a lava flow, which gouged it out. It could have been a tube, which the top of which collapsed. That's also lava having formed, and then a crust forming over the top of that. It could be volcanic gases, they now think, venting.
That could be just a vent hole, that's true.
But anyway, they hope to find out on this trip. They also hope to get perhaps the oldest rocks yet from the moon up there on the Apennine mountain range.
That was Wally Schirra, former astronaut, and Walter Cronkite talking before the launch of Apollo 15. They then went on to discuss the crew members.
A quick word on who these men are. We're going to take a closer look at them a little later this morning, but quickly who they are. The commander of this flight is Air Force Colonel David Scott, 39 years old. He's Air Force all the way. He looks like a model of an Air Force flying officer. He's the son of an Air Force general, Tom Scott. He's married to the daughter of an Air Force general, Isaac Ott. And his middle name is Randolph, because he was the first child born at Randolph Field, the great training ground for airmen in San Antonio, Texas. He was fifth in his class at West Point, got a master's degree in interplanetary navigation from MIT, a test pilot like all of these men. He flew on Gemini 8 with Neil Armstrong, was supposed to make a walk on that flight and didn't get to, because if you remember, that was our first great crisis in space. That was the Gemini spacecraft that, after the first successful docking and undocking, one of the reaction control jets stuck and threw them into a tumbling mode. They were in great difficulty, but they managed to save the spacecraft and make an emergency landing in the Pacific. He also was the Apollo 9 command pilot in an Earth orbital mission. It wasn't the command pilot. Jim McDivitt was the command pilot.
Yes.
But he made the Earth orbital mission the first test of the lunar module. Jim Irwin, who's going onto the moon with him, is the oldest man in this group, 41 years old. He's an Air Force lieutenant colonel, and he's a space rookie. He was born in Pittsburgh, and he's lived everywhere, Utah, Oregon, Colorado, calls Colorado Springs his home. He's a graduate of Annapolis, but went into the Air Force after that. So you've got some Annapolis representation.
You made note of that
there.
Very good.
I did that for you. He had a bad accident in aircraft at one time, broke both legs, his jaw, had a terrible concussion, lost his memory, and it's a wonder that he made it back, but it was because he fought his way back into the program that he got in. Al Worden is an Air Force major. He's 39, like Scott is. He's a space rookie also. Then neither of these men, Irwin or Worden, have made a space flight before. His parents reside in Jackson, Michigan. He's divorced, but like the others, has children. His two daughters are here with him for this flight.
And 40 years ago today, Australian time, yesterday American time, Jack King was the person from NASA who was often referred to as the voice of Apollo, and he called the launch. So let's hear it then, the launch of Apollo 15.
Coming up shortly on the 1 minute mark, we're now 70 seconds and counting. Second stage tanks are pressurized as our countdown continues. Mark, T-minus 60 seconds and counting on Apollo 15. The astronauts are go, launch vehicle and spacecraft components all go as our countdown proceeds. Now 50 seconds, we have the power transfer. The vehicle now on the battery power on the vehicle, and all is still going well. Lunar module pilot Jim Irwin making some final checks, now passing the 40-second mark. Spacecraft commander Dave Scott now has made his final check. That is aligning the guidance system. 30 seconds and counting. The guidance system will go internal at the 17-second mark. Now 25 seconds. We have complete clearance to launch. We are go. 20. 15 seconds, guidance internal, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, ignition sequence start, engines armed, 5, 4, three, two, one. All engines running. Launch commit. Liftoff. We have liftoff at 9:34 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The tower is clear.
And not even a hi-fi system can bring you the enormous noise and power of the Saturn V liftoff. 111-meter tall rocket launching the people towards the moon. And it's sad to note that Jack King, the voice of Apollo, who you heard there calling that launch, died only recently. Now, in last week's The Space Show, we were looking at Michael Collins and his mission aboard the Gemini... I've forgotten already. Gemini 10 mission, yes. And Michael Collins went on to land on the moon, to orbit the moon, not land, and that was on Apollo 11. And we began to play right at the end of the show a piece of music, but we ran out of time to play it properly. So I'm going to reintroduce it and play the full track this evening. Now, Michael Collins was the crew member of Apollo 11 that remained orbiting the moon in the command module Columbia, while Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin flew the lunar module down to the lunar landing. Originally, the lunar module, or LM, was called the LEM. The Lunar Excursion Module, but they later renamed it LM, Lunar Module. Now, Jethro Tull uses the LEM term in this song. In this song, Collins says, "It's a shame that it had to be Armstrong and Aldrin that did the moonwalk." Now, this song was written by Ian Anderson and released in 1970, the year after that landing. The Jeffrey Hammond, who in 1971 became Jethro Tull's new bass player. Hammond has been a longtime friend of Ian Anderson. So here we go for Michael Collins, Jeffrey and Me.
Watery eyes of the last sighing seconds, blue reflections mute and dim, beckon tearful child of wonder to repentance of the sin. And the blind and lusty lovers of the great eternal light, go on believing nothing, since something has to die. And the apes' curiosity, money, power, wins, and the yellow soft mountains move under him. I'm with you, lamb, though it's a shame to be you. The mother ship is just a blade from your train made for two. I'm with you, boy, so please employ just a little care. It's on my mind, I'm left behind when I should have. And the lim-faced hungry viewers fight to fasten with their eyes, like the man hung from the trapeze, whose fall will satisfy and congratulate each other on their rare and wondrous deed.
just saw the monkey seed. And the yellow soft mountains grow very still. Witness as intrusion, the human eye thrill. I'm with you, lad. Oh, it's a shame that it had to be you. The mother ship is just a blip from my trip made for you. I'm with you, boys. So please imply just a little equity. It's on my
the best variety on your radio, 88.3 Southern FM.
On this evening's The Space Show, we are looking back 45 years to the Apollo 15 mission. And one of the novel features of that mission was that it contained the Lunar Roving Vehicle, the first time that a motorized wheeled vehicle had been used on the moon. I say motorized because on Apollo 14, the astronauts did have a little cart, a golf caddy type thing that was able to carry around some of their tools, but they had to drag it themselves. But here they were able to drive. So here's a description stated just before liftoff.
Of course, the big first with this Apollo 15 landing on the moon is the Lunar Rover, that four-wheeled vehicle which will enable the astronauts to stay much longer on the moon than ever before, twice as long as previous trips, and that means twice as much scientific experimentation can take place, and that's the name of the game, science, on this trip. Well, we've got a model of the Lunar Rover, and Nelson Benton and Scott McLeod at Grumman Aerospace in Bethpage, Long Island, can show it to us. Gentlemen?
Walter, the lunar module that is flying as Falcon on the flight of Apollo 15 looks itself pretty much like those that have landed on the moon before. If you had to draw a great distinction between it and previous ones, the distinction is weight. It's carrying about 1,000 more pounds than earlier lunar landers did, and a big part of that additional weight is the lunar roving vehicle, the moon buggy. It weighs 460 pounds on Earth, about 75 pounds in moon weight. Scott McLeod is with Elizabeth Poirot and John Littorello, a couple of sixth graders from Bayport, Long Island, and he's going to tell them how it works. Elizabeth, how'd you like the ride?
It was great.
You liked it?
Yes.
Up on the front of the lunar rover is, of course, a rather complex television assembly. It's going to give us pictures back from the moon.
Is the television black and white, or is it color, and how does it work?
Well, the television camera is a color camera, and all of this is set up so that the ground controllers can control the television camera. That little box under the television camera, you see it's all wrapped in thermal blankets to make sure it doesn't get too hot or too cold. The little box underneath is called a ground control television assembly. And through that little box, the controllers in Houston can make the camera go up or down, right or left. Or if the picture gets too bright, they can change the iris and the lens and change the exposure on that. But they can't do that until this umbrella, this antenna, is properly configured, right, Scott?
Right. That antenna, John, Elizabeth, has to point directly toward Earth, where they can't get a signal back there to make the camera move when they want to. Therefore, when they're traveling from the LEM on their excursion, when they're en route, they can't get any picture back. But once they stop, then Dave or Jim can get out, adjust that antenna back to Earth, and they can get a good, clear picture. John, you had a question, didn't you?
I noticed the wheels, they turn at the same time.
The wheels can turn on either end, just like a fire engine. The back wheels will turn. Scott, show them how the
front wheels go, and the back wheels. both at the same time, in either direction. You know why that is, John?
No.
Well, if we just had the front wheels turn, we could turn fairly sharply. But if we turn both the front and the back at the same time, we can make a very tight turn. And that's the idea.
One more thing about the television camera. After the astronauts have made their three trips from the limb and gone around to do their various exploring and collecting samples, the lunar rover will be positioned some distance from the lunar module. And what we hope to see is a television picture of the liftoff from the moon when the ascent stage leaves the descent stage and takes the astronauts back up to join with the command module. Of course, that has to be done rather trickily, does it not, Scott?
Well, yes, in that there is a delay between the man who's commanding that camera on the ground and the reaction of the camera to move. Therefore, he has to lead whatever action there is and put the camera ahead of where it is so that it'll be in the picture when he gets the signal back to Earth.
The whole reason, of course, for the lunar rover is to enable them to go further, to take more with them, and to bring more back. For example, look at that luggage rack back on the rover. On the previous moon flights, the astronauts carried a lot of this equipment where they went. This time, they can attach it onto the rover and take it along, and they figure that in those three trips, they may be able to bring back as much as 250 pounds of lunar samples.
When the astronauts are on the moon, how fast are they going?
Scott, well, why don't you tell them and show them?
Okay. They will be going, I'd say, about 5 miles an hour. They can go as fast as 10 or 12 miles an hour. But that's pretty speedy to go across an unknown surface. The way they go is to direct these wheels independently with a motor on each one, forward or backward with this hand controller. They can turn right or left, again, using the same hand controller. And they can brake using the controller. So there is no necessity for the feet. Shall we drive?
Don't get lost either. Tell them how you keep
yourself. Oh, okay. The navigation on this vehicle is done here. Now we can tell as we're driving around our distance and bearing back to the lunar module at all times. So that if I'm, say, 2 or 3 miles away from the limb, and I just check on here, it tells me how far away I am and what direction I need to head to go back. John, how'd you like to drive this sometime?
I like it.
You mean here on Earth, or would you like to drive it on the moon?
On the moon.
Well, you'd have to be an astronaut to do that, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Let me show you reverse on it here, okay? Here's the way we go in reverse. How are your studies, John?
Okay.
I think that's one of the most important things. That you have to have very high marks or there's no chance of being an astronaut. You see that slope over here? We could go up something, maybe 25 degrees as far as a steep slope. We can possibly go 45-degree slope driving along the edge of it.
The real thing is fixed so that it can probably last for 115 hours on the surface of the moon.
We
travel 55 miles, although we'll only go maybe 23, 24 miles. As to how long ours is going to last, we'll just have to wait and see at the rate it's going, Walter.
For 22 miles, an $8 million vehicle sounds like a lot of money. But to bring back as much as Nelson pounded out, 250 perhaps pounds of very precious moon rock, well, the scientists think it's more than worth it. Not only is it more than worth it in the actual dollar cost, but the scientists all say and the astronauts agree that it's worth the risk involved in getting to this very difficult spot on the moon.
So, if you want a used vehicle, electric vehicle, and it's free just for the taking, then why don't you pop up to the moon and grab hold of it? It's only got 27.9 kilometers on the odometer, so quite a bargain. All you need to do is take some free batteries with you, although you might have some trouble with the Smithsonian who lays claim to those artifacts on the moon. Now, someone who worked with the astronauts who worked on the Mercury program, then the Gemini program, which we were talking about last week, and then the Apollo program, was Ed Buckby. Now, he wrote a book called The Real Space Cowboys. He's a former director of the Alabama Space and Rocket Center, and earlier this year he spoke to the Space Association of Australia here in Melbourne, And one of the things he mentioned was a description of the lunar roving vehicle. So let's go to the thoughts of Ed Buckby.
The last three flights had a moon buggy, that machine you see on the right. We call it the moon jalopy. Great, great vehicle. And those astronauts loved it. You know, you can imagine, here we are, Corvette drivers. Well, now they get to drive a vehicle on the moon's surface. And they had a ball. And here's a typical drive by John Young, and Charlie Duke is running the commentary. Here we go.
Man, you're really bouncing.
10 miles an hour, top speed. Rough terrain up there. That's the commander speaking, of course, he's in charge. But they had a ball. The dust was everywhere, by the way, all over their clothes, all over the seats. Never could conquer the dust. And that was the, we didn't know what was going on in the press room. Nobody told us they were going to do this. So they, you know, sort of did it themselves. But it worked out fine. They came home safely. But you come up and you'll see the dust coming off those wheels. Those are wire wheels. Yep. Successful Indy 500 on the moon. I talked to Shepard a lot about the moon flight because he was the guy I spent the most time with, had been there. And, you know, he had been through Mercury and he'd watched all the other guys fly and so forth. And I asked him, I said, what do you remember about? And, you know, he told me, he says, it's difficult because it went so fast. And all of them say that we were so busy, you know, running down the list and talking to mission control. It's hard to remember the experience. But he said, there is one event that I remember. He said, I got up the second morning and looked out the window in that spacecraft and saw the Earth, and I could cover it up with my thumb. I could cover up Earth with my thumb. And he said, I realized I was 240,000 miles away from my planet. And he said, that was a memorable event for me. And he said a lot of other guys had a similar experience, realizing how far they were away. I have to show you this clip, and this was another one of those deals where we had no idea that this was going to happen. And it was somewhat difficult to explain for the press because we told them they were up there working very hard, studying things, scientific. And this is Cernan. Jack Schmidt. One-sixth gravity. Can you imagine what Sherrod and Shepard said when they heard one of their colleagues is skipping on the moon? That made some interesting comments at the splashdown party, I can assure you that. Cernan had a problem getting rid of that comment for a long time. This was the critical part of that mission, and we had never seen a liftoff live until Apollo 17. What they did, they parked the moon buggy about 200 yards away from the spacecraft. And on that moon buggy was a television camera. And a guy in mission control could control it with a joystick. And he basically lined the camera up, and we got to see liftoff from the moon, Apollo 17, the first time. I'm telling you guys and gals, that was a wake-up call because you got to understand, we didn't have a backup rocket at the Cape to go get these guys. There was no capability in lunar orbit to come down and pick them up and take them home. They were totally dependent on that little rocket engine and that lunar module, upper stage. And it had worked previously, and this was the last mission. As we watched that, I remembered that we had prepared three news releases. One, all three astronauts returned safely. Second release, one astronaut returned safely, two are lost. Third release, all three astronauts are lost, either on the moon or in lunar orbit. And those briefings, those three briefings, were taken all the way to the White House. The president was prepared, administrator of NASA, Deke Slayton in charge of the astronaut corps, were prepared to deal with a catastrophe like that. But, you know, we put 27 astronauts up there. 12 of them walked on the moon. And we were very fortunate, ladies and gentlemen, not to have a serious problem in lunar orbit. But that was a big deal, that particular flight. Here we go. It goes straight up like an elevator. They're standing up in that spacecraft. They only get about a G and a half on liftoff. And that puts them in lunar orbit. They dock with their mothership. The third guy's up there, and they come home. And that was great to see. But it was a real experience for us to watch that live. And so the last man to walk on the moon was Gene Cernan in 1972. We haven't been back. Nobody's gone out of Earth orbit since then. And we were very fortunate to bring all those fellows home.
And that was Ed Buckby. We're going to hear more from him later in the show. Now, I must pick him up on one point there. He said Apollo 17 was the first time we'd seen a liftoff from the moon. Well, in fact, the lunar roving vehicle was used on both Apollo 15, 16, and 17. All three showed the liftoff, but 17 was the only one where the camera was panned and followed the lunar module ascent towards lunar orbit. The others just showed the liftoff where dust and stuff came out and the lunar module lifted off up out of the picture frame. But 17 was the first one that tracked it. Well, Apollo 15 did set a number of firsts, and let's go back to the commentary before the liftoff, which mentions what some of these firsts were.
Not only is the lunar rover a first for the Apollo 15, but there are a lot of other firsts for this flight. And Leo Krupp, who is our test engineer from North America and helps instruct the astronauts on the command module and has been with us on all of the Apollo flights, is with us here for this time to see the launch in person, Leo. And you can tell us about some of the other firsts on this flight.
Well, Walter, for the first time, the translunar insertion burn is going to put us right into what we call a non-free return or a relax-free return trajectory. In other words, previous flights, we've always injected going toward the moon on a trajectory that if anything happened, we could coast around the moon and come home on a free ride. But we found that this is not necessary. We have enough confidence now, so we're going to change the procedure. And this time, we'll purposely launch on our trajectory toward the moon on a non-free return. This is advantageous to save us a little bit of fuel and is the most efficient way for us to achieve the mission. Probably the biggest first on this particular flight is the incorporation of the instrument module, the scientific instrument module, or the SIMBE as it's called. This is one section of the service module which has a door covering, which will be jettisoned, exposing a complete bay which will have eight very highly sophisticated scientific instruments in it. Oddly enough, this will not be the first time we've jettisoned the door off a quad of the service module. You maybe remember Jim Lovell did this inadvertently, so this is not the primary flight test. However, this time we're going to do it intentionally under more controlled conditions. But as an extra precaution, we will have the crew suited up for this particular maneuver just in case there is a rupture of the pressure vessel. The crew will be suited up in a safe condition. And since the vehicle is not on a free return, the door will also not be in a free return, so it will not stay in lunar orbit. It will hook around the moon, come back toward Earth, and finally end up in solar orbit, so it gets the debris out of the way. But the instruments that are in that SIMBE are quite interesting. We have several experiments which will determine scientifically what the composition of the lunar surface and the lunar atmosphere are. We have some very highly sophisticated cameras. We have a pan camera, which has a resolution of 5 feet at 60 nautical miles. This is rather fantastic. If this particular camera was on a mountain behind Los Angeles, for example, it could look at Catalina and not only see the sailboats in the harbor at Avalon, but could see 5-foot sailors walking around on the deck. So when this is taking photographs of the moon, we hope to be able to pick up the shadows of the astronauts walking around in the shadow of the limb, since it will be over 5 feet. And we also have a mapping camera, which works in conjunction with a stellar camera. When the mapping camera is taking a photograph of the moon, at the same time it's taking another photograph 90 degrees out of plane of the celestial field. So the exact position of the vehicle can be fixed and correlate with the position of the photographs of the moon, and at the same time a laser altimeter is measuring the altitude within 3 feet. So we'll get extremely accurate mapping of the moon surface this time. And this will also be used for Earth resources, because there's a lot of areas on Earth that still need more precise mapping. And probably another very interesting experiment is the sub-satellite. Just prior to the vehicle leaving lunar orbit to come home, the sub-satellite will be ejected, and it has three experiments incorporated in it. And it will stay in lunar orbit for a year after the departure of the command service module, and will send data back. It's self-sustaining, will send data back for over a year. And we hope to learn a lot more about the lunar gravitational field, all these mysterious mass cons that have been perturbing our orbits a little bit for us.
These mass concentrations of some heavy material there that is causing this a little different magnetic gravity.
That's right, and this was reflected to us. I think it caught a lot of people by surprise in Apollo 8 when the orbit didn't stay constant. We had a little perturbation in our orbit, and we learned to live with it, but we want to know more about it, and this will give us the answers we need.
That satellite, sub-satellite's a funny-looking thing, Leo. It's 78 pounds, as I recall. It's 3 feet long and 14 feet in diameter, hexagonal, so it, I don't know, it doesn't look like anything you've ever seen in space really before.
Well, most things that you see in space look like things you've never seen before, because we're not worried about the aerodynamic shape. We're worried about getting the exposure to the sun for the solar panels, for the power, and this kind of thing. And it makes it nice to work in space. You can forget about all the aerodynamics involved.
One of the other firsts on this flight is the highest space walk yet, when Al Worden has to climb out of that command module and go back to the service module and pick up the film he shot. He not only does he have to shoot the film for 3 days up there alone, but he's got to go get it.
That's right. All the experiments will be sending back telemetry real time, which will be gathered at Houston, but the pan camera and the mapping camera will require Al to go out and retrieve those cassettes and bring them back to get the film back home.
You know, isn't it remarkable how far we've come in the space program, Leo? When the first men were walking, that was such a big story that we could hardly stand the thought. The guy was going to get out of that spacecraft and walk around out there and float around in space. And now it's well, we put it almost in parenthesis for the exploration on the moon.
Well, this EVA is really going to be spectacular, because we have a pole rigged which fits on the hatch when the hatch is open, and we'll have a wide-angle TV camera mounted out there, so all the viewers at home should be able to be eyewitnesses to this historic event of walking 200,000 miles away from Earth.
After he came back to Earth, Al Worden wrote a book, and he wrote some poetry as well, and one of them was called Rising from Earth. And we have Patricia Larkin from the Space Association of Australia. Well, she's going to read his poem, Rising from Earth.
Rising from Earth by Alan Worden, Apollo 15. A vibration, a roar, motion, shaking, rattling, we lift straight up. We climb on plumes of thunder into a rising sun and away from reality. Goodbye, my friends, you are gone. The whole world has gone on a trip. But this must be finished. Faster, faster. Can't turn back. Insignificant. I am insignificant. Lights flash, panel moves, floating in nothingness. Then softly, softly, the movement begins again. Push up the switch and suddenly light everywhere. Earth is floating aimlessly, serenely, peopled, I know, by intelligent life. Man is overdriven on vision greater than deed. Floating so far, extending the realm of man. Born again in light of day, and everything is suddenly right.
And that was Patricia Larkin. Now we're going to go back to Ed Buckby and his talk to the Space Association of Australia. And this time he brings it a bit closer to home, talking about Skylab and Australia and a few other things about the Apollo program.
I have to apologize to you on behalf of NASA for using your country as a drop zone for used and unneeded space hardware. Because when we decided to drop Skylab, I was told it was going to land in the ocean. And probably you were told it was going to land in the ocean. Well, it didn't. a lot of the components ended up in your country. And guess what? I ended up at my museum receiving one of them. That's an oxygen vessel that was wrapped in fiberglass. And that's why it survived reentry. You'll see on one end, it's kind of black. That's the end it reentered in. And it survived. And I understand there's a couple more sizable pieces somewhere in Australia that came down from Skylab. So I apologize to you on behalf of NASA for dumping our junk on your country. These are the guys that I worked with, and I look at them as the real heroes of the space program in the USA. They were the first, they were the bold, they're the brave that stepped up and said, we're going to take our flag into space. And they were successful at doing that. And Shepard, again, shared with me a story. The night before he was to fly, he couldn't sleep. Can you imagine? You know, guy's just going to climb on a rocket the next morning, fly 240,000 miles away. So he went out to the rocket launch pad in a pickup truck. In those days, that was pretty common. And he got out of the pickup, was going to go up to the top of the rocket to spacecraft level, about halfway up. And by the way, that rocket's being fueled, and it's bumping and humming, and that fuel's expanding the metal, and it's making a lot of noise. He gets up there about halfway, and he sees a light on. Crawls out of the elevator, sticks his head in this compartment, and there's a guy in there working. So he crawls in the compartment, introduces himself, and finds out this is a technician. Interesting enough, this technician had worked on Shepard's Mercury 7 rocket in 1961. And here he was doing the same thing on Shepard's rocket about to go to the moon. So they talk about the weather, possible delays and aborts and so forth, and football, family, and all that. And finally, the technician says to Shepard, do you know how all these parts on this rocket work? 3 million parts. Shepard says, no, I've never met that guy. And this technician said, I haven't either. But I'm here tonight to make sure my part works tomorrow morning. And guys and gals, that's how we were successful at putting 12 American astronauts on the surface of the moon. They stood on the shoulders of 400,000 men and women in our country who get up every morning and said, I'm going to make my part work. And that's the legacy we leave with the younger generation today in our country and your country. Whatever you just choose to do, make sure your part works. You've been a great audience. Thank you very much.
Ed Buckby, speaking to the Space Association of Australia. Ed Buckby, former director of the Alabama Space and Rocket Center. Before that, he was a public affairs officer at NASA. Quite a fascinating thing. And you might want to look up the book that he wrote, which is called The Real Space Cowboys. A good buy, a good read, well worth the trouble. Now, from time to time, NASA has people come and do art for it, and their first ever artist in residence, I believe, was Laurie Anderson. Now, do you know who Laurie Anderson is? Yes, she's been to Australia a number of times. I went to a wonderful concert of hers at the Arts Centre here in Melbourne, and yes, she has composed a number of things related to space. And while artist in residence, she wrote this next piece of music, which is called The End of the Moon. I shouldn't really tell you this, but I believe that as a result of what this piece of work is, NASA was very unhappy, and they decided not to have another artist in residence, although they have had many artists working for them and doing stuff for them. So here we're going to go with Laurie Anderson and The End of the Moon.
Do you know, starting is always the hard part. It's like stuttering. You're only afraid at the beginning. That's where the fear is. So you only stutter at the beginning of the word, when it's starting. I mean, nobody ever stutters at the end. There's no stuttering. Because by then, it's too late to be afraid. By then, there are only the regrets. Out with a bad day, and I was sitting around in my studio feeling sorry for myself, and the phone rang, and a voice said, "This is so-and-so, and I'm from NASA, and we'd like you to be the first artist in residence here." And I said, "You're not from NASA," and I hung up the phone. About 5 minutes later, the same person called, and I said, "Come on, I mean, I was sure it was a fan who had figured out what my secret dream was and had decided to torture me. Now, finally, I called someone at NASA, and he said that, yes, I had actually been chosen to be the first artist in residence at NASA, and he wanted to see if I was interested. And I said, "Well, what does an artist in residence actually do? I mean, what does that mean with a space program?" And they said they didn't really know what that meant, and what did I think it meant? And I thought, who are these people? I saw Lola Bell's face, and she had one of these brand new expressions. And first was the realization that she was prey, and that these birds had come to kill her. And second was a whole new thought. It was the realization that they can come from the air. I mean, I never thought of that. A whole 180 more degrees that I'm now responsible for. It's not just the stuff down here, the dirt and the rocks and the smells and the trees, but all of this, too. And the rest of the time we were in the mountains, out on the trails, she just kept looking over her shoulder and trotting along with her head in the air. And she had this whole new gait, really awkward. Not with her nose to the ground following the smells, but pointing straight up, sniffing, sampling, scanning the thin sky, like there's something wrong with the air. And I thought, where have I seen this look before? And then I realized it was the same look on the faces of my neighbors in New York. In the days right after 9/11, when they suddenly realized, first, that they could come from the air, and second, that it would be that way from now on. It would always be that way. and we had passed through a door. And we would never be going back. Something that uncoils inside us. A world that comes in through your skin. And dogs hobbling across the mud to a brownish yellow sea. A sick monkey on the beach. The food, however, is delicious. I have to say that much at least. And animals popping out of their holes for a last look before the winter snows. Lights out.
End of the Moon, composed by Laurie Anderson and performed by her. And it was composed as part of her Artist in Residence experience at NASA. Well, more about the moon coming up after this.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
Well, now, we've been looking at the moon, and I think we might just squeeze this in. Why still study the moon?
Hi, thanks. It's Seth Borenstein from AP. I guess this is more to Doug than anyone, but Mike can join in. Given that this administration has changed the goal, cancel constellation, and the moon is definitely on the outs compared to other places, I understand the science value, but can you explain why this has any value in exploration if we're really not going to the moon as a goal anymore, if at most a stopover place? And as a follow-up, can you give me, if we were somehow to go back to the moon as planned in 2000, whenever this was proposed, what are the top three sites? I'm wondering, why is it worth $500 million if we're not going there now?
Well, we haven't ruled out the moon forever, and so it is still a destination of interest in the future for humans. As the LRO data has come in, we've learned a lot more than we've known before it flew, and learn more every day. So we've learned of places that are of high interest. So I think it has tremendous value for the future. As a part of the data collection process, there were, I forget the number, and Mike can probably, or Rich can chime in, but there are quite a few sites that were of interest for both science and exploration reasons. So this is a this is data that will be of value for years and years to come. So it's of high interest. It's bringing back tremendous information about the moon, our nearest neighbor, I wouldn't rule it out as a destination forever. There are extremely interesting places to go.
Yeah, Seth, it's Mike Wargo. Let me add a few more points. One is that with this enormous new insight we have into the moon, this information isn't going to go away. It's not going to get stale, if you will. In fact, it keeps getting richer and richer in terms of our both scientific understanding and our understanding for planning purposes. So the information is timely for us for ongoing planning, but in a lot of ways, it's also timeless. Rich indicated that we're rewriting the textbooks about the moon, and that information is going to be there for both lunar and planetary and solar system scientists, as well as to inform our planning as we move along the flexible path and we develop capabilities to explore beyond low Earth orbit.
And I guess to follow up, the top three potential landing sites given from what you've learned for humans?
Yeah, Doug referred to a number of sites that were looked at in exquisite detail. We had about 50 of them, and the reason we selected them was were numerous. First of all, they represented a very wide range of terrains that were on the surface of the moon, and each one of them had a scientific context that provided them as high priority areas for scientific investigations. All of that information is available, and I'm not sure right now that we've gone through LRO's data in enough detail that we would want to select the top three, because we have ongoing measurements that are occurring during the science portion of the mission, and these will help us identify new areas that look particularly interesting, and we may find new potential high-priority landing sites that weren't among the 50 representative terrain and science areas.
Thank you.